Listeners and viewers, we're back with episode 4 with Dr. Mark Klein, the author of Wisdom from the Aerial View, an absolutely practical book. You can read it in an evening. You'll spend the second evening going back and redlining and highlighting the things that you want to keep in mind. It has an enormous power to reduce anxiety. It has an enormous power to reshape how we think about what could classically have been some of the most devastating experiences of the human life: death, tragedy, anxiety, these burdensome things. And the aerial view gives us an opportunity to sort through those in a very meaningful way and live a very different kind of life with a very different mission. So, Mark, you were a doctor for 45 years, and you're no longer practicing medicine, but you are still practicing as a doctor. Your approach to life hasn't really much changed, I would say. You're still interacting with people. You're still asking them how they're doing. You're still looking to say, can I make a difference in this person's life through this interaction, and can I collect them as one of another people in my tribe? All those things are happening. What would you say are the most important things that we can settle on with our listening and viewing audience about what we do going forward with an aerial view of things?
You know, I as you said, I'm still in a sense a doctor. I'm just trying to scale the one-on-one interactions I had to something larger through this book. And I've tried to do that in all my books, but especially this one. And I look at the world now, we have... What prompted me to write this book? I looked at all the contentiousness. You know, we see the political. I mean, this country is literally tearing each other apart about what, right? About, I think I'm right about this political issue and I think you're wrong. Not only do I think you're wrong, I actually hate you for that, right? And it happens on both sides. And we have this increasing level of mental health issues. We have the rise of suicide in young people. Actually, the number one group, I just learned this recently, the fastest growing group of suicides is in the elderly, right? So, but still young people, we see lots of suicide. We see a tremendous amount of anxiety. I mean, anxiety, you know, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which is a group most people haven't heard of, United States Preventive Services Task Force, they're the group, the government group that decides what tests we should have for our health. Screening tests like mammography or prostate cancer screening or colon cancer screening, they decide what tests we should do, right?
Yeah, I found this observation here is really interesting in the book.
And about a year or two ago, not maybe at the most, they said, we believe that we should start testing people or evaluating people for anxiety. 40% of women and 36% of men have anxiety. And the theory from the United States Preventive Services Task Force is if we identify it early, if we screen for it, meaning doctors should ask patients about it and so on, then hopefully we can intercede. Well, that's so that you have the contentiousness, you know, that we see political contentiousness primarily, and then this mental health issue. I'm thinking, I can't sit by and do nothing about this. I have an idea how we can make it better, right? And that's where the aerial view comes in, because once you elevate to the aerial view and get this perspective of all of time and become the disinterested observer and lose your attachment. There are no teams in the aerial view. There are no winning or losing. Then you start to see all perspectives and you realize, wait a minute, the world is not what I think. It doesn't work the way I think. I have assumed it is. And it allows you to be much more generous, open-minded, and it's a tremendous tool for combating anxiety. So we talked earlier about the fact that each of us has control over how we feel. And Viktor Frankl, as I mentioned, was to me the person who expressed this best, right? That each of us is in control of how we feel. So you couple that with understanding that life, that we're here for a purpose, and that is to make this evolution from selfish to selfless, from inward to outward focus. And all of a sudden you combine those two things, the power to control how we feel and understanding why we're here. And that is a tremendous tool for confronting anxiety. So I'll tell you what I do. And I think I mentioned it in the book. So when I get anxious, I remind myself, and I say these exact words: I'm in control of how I feel. I don't have to feel like this. I don't have to feel anxious. There's no reason to let any outside event or person determine how I feel. I am in control of this. That's an absolute truth. That is a fact. That is not my opinion. Once you embrace that and understand that, you go, oh, okay, I'm in control of how I feel. And it's like anything else. It's like learning to play an instrument. You practice. You do it again and again and again. You can say it 100 times a day. There's no limit. It doesn't cost you anything. And eventually you become to embrace this and understand, yes, I am in control of how I feel. My senses determine how I interpret things. Yes. How? Wow. Unbelievable. I do have that control. And I tell myself that. And now I'll give you an example. Just recently, I was in a situation that created a bit of anxiety for me. And I was finding myself getting nervous, right, over the course of a day or two. And I went, whoa, come on, bring this back. I'm in control of how I feel. And when I say that, I say, I'm not just going to control my anxiety. I'm going to crush it because that has no power over me. I get to decide how I feel. And the underlying principle that supports that is understanding how the world works by viewing the aerial view, by understanding, becoming the disinterested observer and saying, okay, my place in time is limited. I'm born on one day. I die on another day. That's my lifespan. Those are the records that I'm on in the jukebox of time. And no matter what I do, I cannot change the ending. Therefore, longevity cannot be the goal of life. There's something else. Your demise is certain. I don't care if you're the most famous person, the richest person, the most successful person, and we all can name all these people. Every one of them has died and will die. Okay, longevity is not the point. We play the game of life as if we make every correct move, we're going to win. You know, when I was a kid, there were these pinball machines that if you play, you got enough points, you got to go again, right? I don't know if you remember those. Well, they don't exist anymore, obviously, but there's no going again in life, right? You can't make every right move and get to go again. You can't win. Ah, so the purpose is not longevity. I used to think that people who were courageous were dumb. Why would you be courageous if you could lose your life and then you can't do anything? I got that completely wrong, right? Because courage is understanding that longevity is not the point of life, right? That's so if you give your life
to living the life of meaning,
you win, right?
So Mark, I want to kind of, as we begin to wrap our fourth amazing episode together here, I want to kind of talk about something you haven't talked about. So you're in this aerial view, and it's a self-actualized place, or it's a place where self-actualization happens, where you're becoming your best self, and all things are equal, and there's no judgment, and you're able to look at things from a very different perspective. One of the things that we haven't talked about is, I think when everything is gone, except that aerial view and that peaceful perspective of life, time is irrelevant. It's all happening. You have some control. You don't have all control. You'll contribute. Others will contribute. It'll all end up being what it is. What's in the center of that plane of existence, though, is something very powerful, and that's love, compassion, and regard for others, a yen and a yearning to protect the dignity of others. You know, I was thinking about your earlier comments about being politically contentious times, and I had the opportunity to have a dinner with Arthur Brooks, who was head of the American Enterprise Institute for many years, a sort of center-right organization. And he wrote a book, Love Thy Enemy, and he was talking about it at dinner with me and a small group of people. And he said what prompted him to write the book is at the time, he's now stepped away from that role. He's now a professor at Harvard, but he was doing 300 talks a year. He said, I went to one talk where I had what I consider to be a pretty sympathetic audience, a sort of a, you know, center-right group of people that listened to his center-right perspective on the world. And a woman came up to him afterwards and said, you know, what I don't get about what you said is I can't stand those people. You were talking about them, you know, and they're just so horrible. I just can't stand them. And Arthur looked at us and he said, you know, here's the thing I would tell you. I was raised by two loving parents who were both professors and lived in Seattle. One drove a Volvo and one drove a Subaru. Now, if you're putting any of those pieces together, which you could logically and rightfully conclude, is that my parents were not center-right people. I was the black sheep of the family. They were center-left. They are center-left. I love my parents unconditionally. They are the best people on the planet. The idea that someone can come up to me and say, I hate them, just does not fly in the face of things. That's just fundamentally not where we're supposed to be. And it doesn't mean that you have to like them. That's different. But it does mean the one thing you have to take out of the equation is contempt for others, disregard for others, disrespect for others, and replace it with love. Love. Not even liking someone, just loving them and recognizing as a human being, they're entitled to opinions, they're entitled to the same things you are, and that part of the human interaction is equal.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book called Being Right is Overrated, right? So remember we talked earlier about, in one of the early episodes, about we make a choice, it's this balloon, it goes out into the world, it gets bombarded. And right. I tell people, you know, we would assume the president of the United States or Vladimir Putin or, you know, any country that has a nuclear weapon, they have much more power than somebody who just has a regular job as a, you know, a plumber or an electrician in a small town in the United States. We'd say, well, there's an asymmetry there, right? You know, the Vladimir Putin's of the world or the president of the United States has this much power and the other person is like way, way down here. Wrong. Wrong. Everybody creates, this is another chapter in the book about reality. Reality is the summation of all the choices made by all the people. So we might think that the president of the United States has all the power, but somebody 20,000 miles away can make a decision, make a choice that creates this cascade of events that ends up having this humongous effect on the world. So these are why you have to, you know, I always say, in a sense, you have to become an iconoclast. You have to stop. I'm done with conventional wisdom. It's almost always wrong. So, which is why when somebody says to me, like they said to you, I hate those people, how could you possibly hate them? Your job is to help as many people as you can. It's be as kind as you can. You got it exactly backwards. If you think you're right, first of all, you could easily be wrong because everybody's been wrong. And there's a good chance, there's 100% probability you're going to be wrong again. So why do you think on this particular one you're right? Why are you putting the stake in the ground on this one? You've been wrong before. You're going to be wrong again. Why are you so sure you're right on this one? The first thing should pop into your mind is maybe those other people are right and I'm wrong. Or at least their opinion has some validity to it. Let me find why they feel that way. If half the country feels a certain way, I have friends who say to me, I hate every Republican. And I go, there's like, you know, or hate everybody who voted for Trump. I go, there's like 70 million of them. You're going to hate. They're all terrible people. I go, think about what you just said. That's impossible. I guarantee you they're not all terrible people. And probably hardly any of them are terrible people. They just see the world differently. So understand that you could be wrong. They could be wrong. The point is have that humility and don't worry about it. From the aerial view, you understand that this election or any particular political event is just one moment, one record in time. The universe will go on. There's another story. The story is not who wins the election. The story is how you live your life and whether you have made that or are making that evolution to being a more kind, generous, and selfless person. That's the focus. If you do that, and if you work hard, in order to do that, you have to make some of your life. You have to have accomplishments. You have to learn. You have to be educated. You have to make the effort, right? All these things count, right? But that's what you should be focusing on. And the first thought should be, I might disagree with those 70 million people, but A, by definition, they can't possibly all be wrong or horrible people. Not wrong, they can't all be horrible people. And therefore, I need to reevaluate how I'm seeing this. I need to focus on myself and saying, why am I making this judgment? What am I doing wrong? How am I misinterpreting the world and my life to make this? So love, the most powerful thing in the world, that moves the whole, that is, as you said, if there's one word that's what moves the needle. And if you want to be happy in your life, this is the bottom line. If you want to have a joyful life, I always tell people when things are bad in your life, go help someone else, right? When things are really low, go help someone else. You'll feel better.
So, Mark, as we wrap this up, I have a question for you. So we've come to know each other over the last 6 months, and I can honestly say you're a very good friend. You've become a very good friend. I really appreciate listening to you. I really appreciate the insights you've shared, both in your book, but also with us over these past four episodes. You know, my son has an interesting observation about people. And when he looks at people and you say, wow, that person is so great. There's so many nice things about them. They're just amazing in so many different ways. He said, when you get overcharged about that idea, be very careful, because people who are like that can very oftentimes be serial killers. So his view is simply that no one is perfect. Everyone has foibles. And for our listening and viewing audience, let's listen to this very, very animated, inspiring lesson in ascending into the aerial view. I want to hear about one of your foibles to put you and ground you in the earth so that people will know you're not just this great guy, this extraordinary mensch, this very visionary doctor who has some very powerful wisdom and is doing a lot to change the world as we know it. What's one of your foibles?
Well, you asked me a simple question. I thought you were going to ask me something hard. So I mentioned in the book, everything I talk about, I've gotten wrong. I've judged people. I continue to judge people. Now at least I'm smart enough to know, whoa, you just judge that person. You know, God's going to give you a little whack over the head, right? God has a sense of humor, right? So I have been terribly impatient to, you know, and I'm getting better finally, but I've been terribly impatient. I've judged people poorly. I've been unkind. I've been disrespectful. You name it. You know, I, you know, it's funny, but I look at this conversation between you and me, and you said we've been friends for 6 months and you enjoy it. And I go, well, the pleasure's all mine. I mean, I got to meet somebody who's super interesting, who's trying to do the right thing in the world, who's obviously super kind and generous. And, you know, so I look at it, I go, I'm the winner here. I mean, so I'm glad you feel that way, but perfect? Nobody's perfect. Remember, it's an evolution. You can't be perfect. You're evolving. That's all you got to worry about. Try not to make the same mistake again. Try and be better today than you were yesterday. Try and be kinder. Try and be more generous. You're not going to get it all right. Judge people favorably. Understand that you have been wrong before. You will be wrong again. Have that humility. Respect others. You know, this whole thing about respect. You know, people demand respect. No. Respect is, you got it backwards. Respect is what you give people. It's not what you expect from people. My job is to respect you. If you treat me horribly, it doesn't matter. I still have to respect you, right? So it's not something I deserve, you know. Absolutely. It's backwards, right? So, you know, I've done a million things wrong. Like I said, I haven't killed anybody. I haven't done anything that I consider heinous, but I've been unkind.
So here's my tribute to you, Mark. After reading the book earlier this week and then going back and rereading passages, I was completely inspired by it. And I said, okay, over the next couple of days, I want to put it into practice. And just yesterday, I was in Hamtramck, which is a Polish community inside of Detroit, where I do all my shopping. That's where my people are. That's where my tribe is from. My grandmother and I used to go to lunch at Polonia's there every week. And so I'm going into the Polish grocery store, and this disheveled older man, probably in his 70s or 80s, comes up to me and says, can you drive me home? And I said, oh, where is home? And he said, down on Woodward. When I get there, I'll be able to tell you I'll be able to recognize it. But he was a little off, you know. And so I said, yeah, I'm just going into the store, but let me think about it. I'll be back out in a few minutes and we can talk. And so, you know, all these things rattle through my head. You're not supposed to pick up strangers. You're not supposed to do these things. And then I really had this epiphany as I was thinking about this book. And I thought, the only thing I need to know is whether or not this guy is sufficiently unstable that he will do me some personal harm if I put him in my car. That's all I need to know. Doesn't matter that he may not have the best hygiene. It doesn't matter that he may be off a little mentally or conversationally. So I went into the store, and one of the first things I asked the clerk at the cash register was, hey, do you know that elderly guy that's out in the parking lot right now? He said, yeah, he's around here a lot. I said, is he any problem? Is he disruptive or, you know, does he freak out or do anything unusual? And he said, no, he's generally pretty harmless. He'll talk your ear off, and he's got all kinds of strange stories. But so I got my groceries. And before I had a chance to even think no, he followed me back into the grocery store and said, you know, are you still going to be able to drive me? And I said, absolutely. So I got out, got in my car, made place for him in my car, took him home. And the and he said, you know, I told you I was going to pay you $35. And I said, I don't want your money. And so he's getting out of the car and he drops $20. I don't know if it's accidental or not. And I said, hey, before you go, you dropped $20 there. You need to take that too. I really don't want your money. And he just looked at me. And it was in that moment that I said, wow, I've learned the power of this book. It is so easy if you really put your creative mind to it, to get all the anxiety cleared away from any potentially unsettling, inexplicable moment, reduce the risks, and do the right thing and do what's best. And that's the lesson that I took away from your book. And I can tell you from the feeling I had the rest of the day, my heart was elevated.
Of course.
My heart was like, large.
Right.
And for that, I thank you, Mark. You really enlarged my heart. You really have. So the last thing I'm going to ask is, can you come back? Can you join us again? I want to check in over the next couple of months and have you back, come back and continue this conversation. I would be honored.
Right. And I'm so glad you had that experience.
Great. A million bucks.
Well, you're a good guy, Ron.
So to our listening and viewing audience, you have heard from one of the most animated, inspiring people I have encountered on this journey we call Disrupted. Thank you for joining us. I hope you've listened to all four of these episodes. I hope you'll engage with us. And mostly, I'll hope that you find yourself at the perch of that aerial view and you're looking down with some sense of dispassion and serenity, and you're finding your way in the world to make a difference. And if that's happened, then this was a really, really great conversation. And I thank you, Mark, for having it with me today. This has been Disrupted. Until the next time, it's Ron Stefanski. Take care, be well, and get disrupted with us.